The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 279 premium for Thursday, August 12th, 2010.
Welcome to your Mac Geek Gab. This is the Mac Geek Gab. I'm Dave Hamilton, of course, here in Durham, New Hampshire today. And joining me, as always, it wouldn't be
John Efron here in
him. But we couldn't do it without
no,
you.
No, it wouldn't be.
It was
no, you'd be talking to yourself.
I think so.
John Efron, Fairfield, Connecticut. And boy, we've both been busy little beavers lately, Dave.
We have. That's right. You have done, this will be your fourth podcast this week. Is that right, John?
Yeah, they just all piled up. So, of course, Monday we did our regular. Then Tuesday was Mac Jury.
Okay.
Wednesday was Mac Roundtable. Mac Jury, the topic was the, as you may have seen, the Microsoft has a recent kind of lame ad campaign telling people why Windows 7 is better than the Mac.
Okay. All right.
So we had a lot of fun with that. And cool. Then Mac Roundtable, which we always like to see you sit in, Dave. Maybe you will one day.
I aim to someday. It now that we have a consistent schedule there, I'm hoping that it comes around. So.
And then today, and then also I voted not once, but twice this week. So, of course, there was a primary earlier in the week and then just got back from voting for a they won a bond $350,000 for a girls softball field in the town. And
so you voted and you just wrote them a check, right?
In these trying times, I'm going to say
become
that,
a
you know, that's
haven't you?
Well, I number one, I don't have any children that could even possibly take advantage of a girls' softball field,
right,
and I don't understand why they can't just use another one. I mean, there are plenty of ball fields in town.
What about the people that have four girls that want to buy your house next and turn it down because it's in a town without a girls' softball field?
Well, they can vote yes.
Well, but then maybe they don't live there yet. This is the wrong show for this, isn't it, though?
Yes, it is. And then, Dave, you actually, you've been on the road or on the train.
Right? Yeah, that's right. So, obviously, we did our show Monday. And then Tuesday, I took the train down to Princeton, New Jersey. Well, I took it to Trenton, but close enough. And spoke Tuesday night at the Princeton Mac User Group meeting, which is always a real blast. And I always look forward to going down there. There's such great people. And they take such good care of me. They're such gracious hosts, and they're so engaged. It's a really, really great mug. And so I went down there and I put together, it was kind of an experimental session because it was a little bit, it was something I'd never delivered that way before, but I essentially pulled together a lot of cool stuff found that we've talked about in the show or that I've found elsewhere, things that I just love. And talked about them and, you know, had lots of cool stuff in there. I can't even remember everything we talked about, but by and large, the biggest impact was, can you guess, John? It's something we've talked about a couple times recently, and it's not necessarily a Mac specific thing, but it's life changing. Can you guess? I haven't.
I believe you posted a photo, Dave. Is this what you're getting at?
I'm not sure I posted a photo. I don't think I did.
Well, I did see you post a photo of an accommodation that they made.
Yeah, that's different. So, the thing that the audience responded most favorably to was Lucy Phone, believe it or not. So that definitely was the highlight of the night for many people. No, what I posted a picture of to my Twitter account was when I got there and I was in a couple of different lecture halls in this same building. Just as I was kind of walking around beforehand, I went and made a phone call, and I always sort of pace when I'm on the phone. And I noticed it in the one I was in, and then I noticed it in several others where they had basically every adapter you could possibly need to hook your Mac or really any computer at that level up to a VGA port for the video projector in the room. And they had them all wrapped together real nicely on a kind of a coily cord, like you'd find a pen at the bank or whatever, so that you knew they would always be there, always right where you needed them. And super, super handy. The only thing they didn't have on these was the new dock connector to VGA adapter, which you'd use with the iPad if you were going to run a presentation from that. And I'll use that as a segue to rant very quickly and briefly about Keynote for the iPad. On the train down, I thought, oh, you know what? I've got the MiFi with me. Let me go ahead and buy Keynote for the iPad. I kept meaning to. I just didn't have any reason. But I was doing this session in Keynote, and I thought, wouldn't it be cool to do it from the iPad? So I downloaded it, and then I went through the hokey pokey of getting something to copy to the iPad going via iWork. And actually, I think I did it some other way, but it didn't matter. I got it into Keynote, and the first thing it tells me is we've stripped down your presentation. We've taken all the transitions out and all the QuickTime movies, because we don't support playing QuickTime movies in presentations on the iPad. And that's like half my presentation, because what I do is if I'm going to demo something like say default folder, which I did talk about, I'll go through and using Snap Z Pro 10, I will go through and make a movie of it working exactly as I want. And that way, when I get to the presentation, I hit play on the movie. It happens right inside Keynote. I can zoom in, zoom out. And this way I know it's going to work, right? Because it's a movie of it working, not it, you know, me actually demoing it. And then I don't have to click and press. I can just talk through what's happening. So it works out in a much more smooth fashion. But of course, without that, you know, I couldn't. So I did it from my MacBook Pro like I was planning to. But real drag that I can't get Keynote on the iPad to work the right way, because it would be so cool if I could. But anyway,
it's getting there. Mm-hmm. You're an early adopter. You should be used
absolutely.
To,
yeah, I wasn't. Sort of pain. I wasn't surprised. I was disappointed. Let's put it that way. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you know, it's funny because one of the points that they made in this Windows 7 campaign was getting back to the projector thing, is that most Windows machines have a VGA port and they plug right into a projector. And we blasted that as being like kind of a lame justification to get a PC or a Windows 7 machine.
Wow.
Anyways, no, but you know, I got to say, when I was in the corporate world, I couldn't believe the amount of time that people wasted trying to set up projectors and computers, whether they be PCs or Macs. There's always some technical glitch, whether it be the projector doesn't sync up, or it doesn't understand the resolution on the computer, or the computer gets confused, or
one thing. And I did it the other night without even thinking about it. You know, I plugged into the projector, and of course, as we've come to expect, nothing appeared on the screen. Right. Okay. Perfect. Yep. So I open up the display system preferences, and the first thing I do is click on detect displays. And I would say maybe not 9 times, but maybe 7 times out of 10 that solves whatever problem is happening with the projector. And boom, the image appears, and you know, you're totally good to go and happy, happy for it. So
that's a good point. I think it twiddles whatever video lines and most things will say, oh, something's happening, I better pay attention to it. So,
right.
Yeah, I found more often than not that whatever device I hook up to will know. Like when I hook my HD TV up to the Mac, the Mac is like, oh, there's something there. Right. Maybe that's just because of the DVI port, because I typically go to the DVI port.
Sure. Yep.
Anyway, so you brought the iPad, Dave.
Oh, and I brought my MacBook Pro.
You did.
Well, I had
and
to.
You know, yeah, I understand.
Yeah,
and
okay.
And that's but I think that's a little lead in, Dave, if I may provide a little lead in into a recent, like just today, tale of woe that you may want to tell us about, and we can talk through what happened to you just today, right?
Yeah, well, it here's the interesting thing. On Tuesday on the train, I had my MiFi going, and I noticed my brother was on Skype. So I actually had a short video chat with my brother while I was on the train. And I thought, well, that's cool. You know, I did it from my MacBook Pro and worked fine. And then that night, after my presentation, I noticed my eyesight was not showing up in my Skype preferences anymore. And I figured, well, it needs a reboot, but I didn't really care because I didn't have anyone I wanted to chat with anyway. But I noticed it was sort of weird. Then today, you know, so I took the train back yesterday. Today in the office, I did want a video chat, and it came up, and the person's like, oh, I can't see you. And I thought, oh, that's right. I got to reboot, because sometimes that happens where, you know, you just need to reboot your Mac to get it to see whatever piece of hardware. So I rebooted, no good. Oh, no. So I shut down, then brought it back up. No, no good. I shut down. I did a PRAM reset. No good. I did an SMC reset, which on my MacBook Pro is you shut it down, you unplug power, you pull out the battery because I can, and then you hold the power button for 5 or more seconds, let go, plug it all back in. No dice.
Ooh. Now, I'm going to suggest, let's go through the troubleshooting here. So the first thing I would suggest, Dave, because you and I have the same MacBook Pro, would be to get System Profiler.
Yes.
And I'm sure you did this, but I just want to walk through how I would try to analyze this issue.
Absolutely.
So, of course, the EyeSight camera on your computer and on my computer, of course, is a USB device. So the first thing I would do is start up System Profiler, look at hardware, and then look at USB.
Yep.
And at least on my machine, I'll see a number of USB buses. Actually, I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of them. Two of them are marked as high speed, and under one of the high speed categories, it says built-in EyeSight.
That's right.
So I'm going to gather that you checked there, and I guess my question is, because I'm trying to guess what the problem would be.
Yep.
Do you recall if you saw all of the USB buses that I mentioned?
So I did. I'm relatively familiar with my System Profiler, and I did. It was the first thing I checked even before I rebooted the first time. And I'm fairly familiar with what I see out there, and I did see all of my buses. Okay, fine. So
USB is working, so they rule that out,
right?
I would say.
Now, after one of my reboots, and I believe it was after I did the SMC reset, though I've seen this happen once or twice since then, and I did not do an SMC reset. But after one of my reboots, I launched System Profiler first, as I've been doing every time since I started troubleshooting this, and again looking in that spot. And I saw the built-in EyeSight appear, and I thought, oh, great, that did it. And I launched iChat because I figured, let me do it with Apple software, not with Skype, just in case. I mean, I never had a problem where Skype didn't see the camera and EyeSight did, but iChat did, but let's stick with the straight and narrow here. And as soon as I launched it, it said, no, there's no camera connected. And I looked back in the System Profiler and it was gone. To the point where I wasn't convinced that I'd seen it in the first place. But I've repeated that particular step a couple of times, not every time, but every now and then I'll see it. And then I launch anytime something tries to talk to it. Boom, it goes away.
OK, now another tool I would suggest, and I don't know if you have this on your machine, but I found this useful and I've actually used it in the past to diagnose USB problems. There is something called a USB prober.
Oh, I should check that. I have not tried that yet.
OK, and that is something I believe you have to install the Xcode.
Okay.
So this is something that takes it to the next level. I mean, it shows you the descriptors in great detail. It also shows you, and this is going to be another suggestion I'm going to offer you, Dave, is that it does show you all of the kernel extensions that have to do with USB.
Yep.
Now, another thing I'm going to propose, and you may want to try this, but I don't know how it would happen, but maybe one of your kernel extensions is damaged.
Believe it or not, that was actually my first thought. And the reason is because I recently started playing around with this app called Air Display, which is something I think I'll wind up using quite a bit when I travel. The idea is you're someone who has a laptop, and then when you're at your desk, you plug it into a larger monitor and that's great. But when you travel, you don't have that monitor with you. And so you're cramped on screen real estate. And actually this app could work for someone who just uses their laptop at a desk. The idea is it uses it could use your iPhone, but really it works better with an iPad because it's larger and extends your desktop. You run an app on the iPad, you run a kernel extension, which affects the display properties on your Mac, and it lets you do desktop extension over to the iPad. You can also do mirroring, but that starts getting really weird. And you just connect them both to the same Wi-Fi network, and they're happy and it works. So I actually had set that up prior to my trip, because I was going to talk about it. It was one of the things I'd queued up to talk about on Tuesday night, and I wanted to test it first. So anyway, I knew it had put this kernel extension out there, and I thought, yeah, okay, that's my problem. But here's the thing. Every night, my system does a clone of my boot drive. And I hadn't installed this until Monday. Okay. I had a backup from Sunday. Now, I know my camera worked Monday. I know my camera worked Tuesday. But because I had packed up my computer before we did our podcast on Monday, and so it did not back up to the drive that's sitting here. So this drive was fresh as of Sunday, which in this case turned out to be a really good thing. I had you know, a known working copy I could go back to. Same exact symptoms. You know, eyesight sometimes shows up, sometimes doesn't, but it never actually works when you try to access it. So,
all right. Well, that would lead me away from a software issue.
Well, yes, I at that point, I was 99% certain it wasn't a software issue, but I figured let's go to the 100% mark. So I booted from, I've actually tried it from two DVDs. I tried it from the DVD that came with my Mac. I also tried it from the Snow Leopard DVD. Those have, when you get to the installer, you can go to the utilities menu and go to System Profiler. So you're running System Profiler off an OS that was burned to a DVD and presumably hasn't been changed since then. So, yep, same thing. No built-in eyesight shows up. Not good. So then, do you have anything to add here, John, before I talk about my final step here?
I'm going to add it after, because I think I know your final step. Okay. And I have something to add to complement that. And actually, go ahead.
Okay. So while I had my DVD out of the DVD that came with my Mac, I knew that there was hardware diagnostics on there. Now, I don't hold a whole lot of faith in hardware diagnostics, but I figured, well, it's here. Let me try it out. So to invoke this, I rebooted and held down the D key with that DVD in, and that goes into diagnostics mode. Now, for those of you that are new to the Mac since Mac OS X was released, this hardware diagnostics is going to look really foreign to you because it's got a total OS, like, it's not even an OS 9 interface. It's like an OS 7 interface, the way the buttons are and everything, but it works.
Yeah.
So I launched it, and there's two modes. You can run the test or you can run the extended test. I know that the extended test does mostly just more RAM testing. I'm not sure if it does anything else, but I didn't want to wait an hour for it to test. I was into the 3-minute thing, and then if it looked okay, maybe I'd run it while we were, say, recording the show now, because this all happened earlier today. So I ran the test, and in 3 minutes, it came up, and it said, "Alert, Apple hardware test has detected an error. 4 Victor Delta Charlie /1/4 with 603: video controller."
Ooh.
And I shut my machine down. I rebooted again from the same disk and ran the test again and came up with exactly the same error. Not good.
Video controller?
So here's what's funny, right? The built-in eyesight, though it involves video, is not really part of the video controller chipset on the machine. It's part of either hardware wise, it's part of the display assembly. And then interface wise, as you pointed out earlier, John, it's part of USB. So this tells me I have a slew of problems going on.
And obviously, I mean, your built-in screen is working, right?
It works, as does the machine, as does an external monitor. I have a 23-inch screen that I connect it to, and that works fine.
Hmm.
But, you know, I'm thinking back, when was the last time it worked? Well, it was on the train. And what did I do after I got off the train? I went and I took my MacBook, and because I couldn't plug my iPad into the projector, I plugged my MacBook Pro into the projector. Now, many other people have plugged computers into this particular projector. I don't think there's necessarily a gremlin in the projector, but there could have been a spark. It might be totally unrelated, but it's also possible that I, you know, shuffled my feet on the carpet the wrong way and grabbed the wrong thing at the wrong time and yada, yada, yada. You know how it goes. I could have shortened it out by doing that. I don't know, because I didn't run a hardware test before and after. It, you know, I don't know if I've ever run a hardware test on this machine, so I couldn't tell you if this video circuit, because other than the eyesight, there are no symptoms of a video problem.
Right. Okay. And did you cover this? I'm sorry, I was distracted for a bit. Did you? So Apple hardware test allegedly identifies something in the video hardware as an issue. Did you try another camera?
Yes, that's a good question. Actually, I happened to have
either FireWire or USB or whatever. We have FireWire. Right? Do you have an old eyesight?
I do. And in fact, when we do video shows and Pilot Pete is here, I use my old FireWire eyesight so that I can have two cameras connected to the iMac here in the studio, one built in and one over FireWire. So yes, I had it and it was readily accessible. So I grabbed it, I plugged it in, worked totally fine, had a video chat with my brother. Everything was happy and hunky dory. So
I think it's lying. I think Apple hardware test is trying it's lying to you.
Maybe.
But anyways, I'm sure Apple Care will take care of you. Now, the only thing I want to mention is, you may have heard of this, Dave, but I haven't seen this for a while. And it was just the other day that Justin, one of our listeners, I'm not sure if he's a premium, if he is, thank you, Justin. He messaged me on Twitter the other day and said, do you know the ASD version for a particular machine? I'm like, what's ASD?
Right.
Do you know what ASD is, Dave?
Apple Service Diagnostic.
Excellent, because I think I had in the past at one point managed to find. So, anyways, Apple Service Diagnostic. As far as I know, this is a tool that the cool Apple kids use. It's not something that's generally available to regular people like me and you, Dave.
Right.
This is what they use at the service center, and I think it's like Apple Hardware Test. Like Apple Hardware Test Plus,
right?
And that I think it will probably go into a level of detail. Now, if you could find it, maybe that would, you know, open up another layer here. The other thing I'm thinking, Dave, is that from what I do recall, you're under Apple Care, so you should have TechTool Deluxe. And I do remember the TechTool Deluxe a specific test that beats up on the VRAM. And I'm wondering if it's the VRAM. Who knows? It can hurt to run TechTool Deluxe and see if it can give you more detail, because the error sounds weird in that I don't know if I entirely believe that it's the video circuitry.
I agree with you, actually. So, I mean, what this is telling me is that there is at the very least a problem with my motherboard. And one mm-hmm. thing that I have not thrown in to the mix yet that I will is I've got two USB ports on that machine, one on the left, one on the right. I happen to plug I have a hub that it's kind of a USB spider setup, right? There's hubs and powered hubs and various devices, but they all come into one cable so that when I plug my computer in, I can just plug in one cable and I'm good to go. And it never had a problem with it. And I didn't this time either. I had all the stuff connected and I went to USB in the system profiler and it showed me all the stuff, which was great. And then I thought, well, let me unplug this and see if maybe I'm drawing too much current with all my stuff. And that's what's causing the eyesight to fall off the bus. Now, it's never happened before and I haven't added anything, but, you know, hey, we'll check that. So I unplugged it and I refreshed and I saw all my stuff, which I should not have seen. It was enumerating the USB bus once and never doing it again. And then I moved it I moved the cable around to the other side and it saw all my stuff twice. And then I unplugged and it only saw it once. But then I rebooted and I have not been able to make that recur. But still, it tells me there's something wrong with the USB bus, at least one of the USB buses on my computer.
Okay.
So, you know.
Okay, we'll try the USB prober. You may see something. I think that may be the best tool. And I did find it's in Xcode. Version it is, or I'm going to say at least I found it on my machine in Xcode redacted version /application/utilities. And there's something called USB prober that will give you tons of USB specific. I think it actually lets you monitor USB traffic. So
cool.
Maybe we'll see if it's, you know, anyways,
I'll check it
great.
Out.
Yeah. So I think this was a value, even though it's about all about you, Dave.
It was all
I think
about
this
me.
Was a value because I think we did. Hopefully we identified some good tools or just a good process that you could use to track this down. I'm very sad that it because I just tried mine because I was afraid that my machine was dying. I just ran quickly photo booth.
So
the green light came on my camera. So I believe that it's working.
That's
of course,
thing.
I saw my smiling face on the screen. So
well, there you go. So I have one last thing that I'll talk about with this. I have the run core drive in that machine. Now it's been in there for a while and the machine has actually been serviced, under Apple Care since then, at the local Mac repair shop. Here's the thing. I know from talking to various technicians that own independent Mac repair shops that Apple frowns on them when they submit a repair for a machine that involves multiple parts. And I'm not sure why this is. My guess is they, you know, if you have lots of repairs with multiple parts, chances are what you're doing is you're stockpiling the extra parts, right? You're saying, well, Timmy needs a new motherboard, so we might as well order him a new keyboard too, right? And then, you know, you stuff the keyboard that you got for Timmy away, and I don't know, maybe Apple thinks their repair departments are going to, you know, do things like this, or their third party repair departments. So they very much frown on this, to the point where third party, you know, independent Apple repair shops typically will not order multiple parts, even if they think there's a good chance they'll need them. And in this case, you know, we know there's something wacky with the motherboard. There might also be something wacky with the display assembly, but I know they're only going to order one or the other when I bring it in, unless I, you know, play real nice with them and try and talk them into it. So, because I don't want it to take forever. But when you send it into Apple, you know, via mail, they'll replace tons of parts. In fact, I've had them replace, you know, DVD drives and all kinds of things that were unrelated to my problem because they tested the machine and decided that one or more other components needed to be swapped out. So I'm tempted, instead of bringing it to my local guy, maybe given all these wacky things, maybe I should send it in. But I'm a little concerned about that Runcore drive. You know, my local guy knows that I put the Runcore drive in and there's no problem with that. I'm a little concerned. I know we say that Apple doesn't really care, but, you know, that's one thing to say. And then another thing to send my precious drive off and hope that it comes back. So I don't know the magic answer there. So I'm going to have to do a little soul searching before I see if I'm going to stand on that, which I've said in the past.
All right, brother.
So I just wanted to be honest about that.
I'm glad you're searching your soul. I think everybody should do that every now and then.
While I'm being honest, a quick correction. In the last show, I talked about Powerline. I mentioned Powerline 500. That's not out yet. That's not what I have. I'm using Powerline AV 200, not 500. So I just wanted to set the record straight on that one.
Okay. And you know how I found out? So actually, we had a listener write saying, well, I went to the, is it Netgear? Mm-hmm. Sorry.
That's right. The Netgear Powerline AV 200. Thank you, John.
Right. And he said, well, I went to the website and, you know, of course, in the extensive show notes that I always put together, Dave, yes. I linked to what you gave me and what you talked about, you know, trusting you to. Anyways, he was trying to find the part number and couldn't find it.
Right.
And I looked as well. And I'm just going to toss out a little tool that I like to use. So, of course, Google is the greatest, I think, for just finding anything. But anyways, what he did is he, you know, they gave a specific model number.
Yep.
I found that frugal.com is a wonderful tool for shopping for things in general. That's Google's shopping engine, if you will. But basically, I punched in the part number and it didn't come up. And to me, if a part number does not come up in Frugal, then it doesn't exist. And as we found, it doesn't yet exist.
I'll buy that.
At least not the 500, which right. I guess is the pro version, or I guess they say the power user version. I guess the AV 200 is the
one. And that's why I was confused, because when the AV 200 came out, it was billed as the pro version, you know, and so on and so forth, because you know, they just keep getting faster and faster with this power line stuff. The one I have maxes out, as I said, at 200 megabits per second. The 500 in theory maxes out at 500 megabits per second. So it's just constantly getting faster and faster. And as it does, what once was the pro version now becomes the, you know, the right. High end consumer version or whatever, you know, and it just keeps rolling around and around.
All right. I'm sorry. So they break it down. So the version that you have is called the Work and Play.
Yeah. See, it wasn't when it first came out. Right.
And then the 500 is called the High Performance. Anyways.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Good one. What's next here?
Do you want to? I know we just spent a lot of time talking about my MacBook Pro. Do you want to talk about your cable modem thing, or should we wait for Monday to do that?
Let's skip that. I'm still okay. In the data gathering phase. All I'm going to say is that I've been having weird readings from the DOCSIS page, which is 192.168.100.1, I believe. I've been getting blackouts, and one of the values is out of spec, but I got to collect enough data because a guy did come out. He replaced everything from the pole down to the house. I did some diagnostics based on your suggestion, Dave, and let's talk about it later.
Okay.
Again, I haven't come to a conclusion yet.
All right. A couple of things then that I want to touch on here. One is that one of my favorite diagnostic critical use utilities is called Applejack. And what it does is you install it and it essentially adds some scripts to be used at the command line in single user mode. Okay. So if you get a problem, you can't boot into your Mac, you hold down Command S, you're now brought to the command line in single user mode. But other than it telling you how to do a kind of a routine file system check, you have no other instructions there. You have to know what you're doing in order to make that really valuable. Well, Applejack is something you install ahead of time before disaster strikes, and it adds kind of a menued option there right at the command line. So you can do various other things, permissions. You can pull out the old swap files in case there's a problem there. Lots of good stuff. And you can even tell it, go ahead and do everything, clean me up and then get me on my way. Up until about a month ago, this was not compatible with Snow Leopard. And now it is. So I just wanted to make a quick mention of this, that now, yes, it is available for Snow Leopard. And I will repeat my recommendation. Definitely go and install this. It's it's one of those things that you will thank yourself for doing so when the moment hits. So
I'll try it.
It's good stuff.
I've not used it, but it's a good. All right. So the old version just wouldn't work.
No, because, you know, at the command line is where a lot of things change. So somebody just, you know, they just needed to go through and kind of repoint things and, you know, do this, do that. So, yeah. Good stuff.
Okay, cool. One thing I want to mention, Dave.
Yeah.
Meteor showers tonight and tomorrow night.
That's correct. That's right.
At least in the Northeast. I'm not sure where.
The Perseids.
Yes. And I think it's for and unfortunately here it's cloudy all day and night. But I think tomorrow we may get a view and
cool.
Basically just hang out outside and just look up and you should see it. I don't think you need any special equipment.
No. We've seen them here, and we've even got a lot of tree cover and stuff. But the best man was in Texas. We had, you know, it's flat there, or at least where we were, it was relatively flat. Big sky country, and we had our big field, so we didn't have a whole lot of trees around. We'd actually lay in the back of our flatbed pickup truck and watch the Perseids each year. It was pretty
sweet.
Cool. Yeah.
Okay. Should we get to our questions?
Yeah. Let's get to our questions. That's a good idea. All right. Let's go to Philip.
Hi, John, Dave, and Pilot Pete. Great podcast. I thoroughly enjoy listening to you all. I have a question for you. I'm about to purchase an iMac 27-inch, and I have a MacBook Pro, which is about 3 years old now. Now, my situation is I have the iMac in a property that doesn't have any internet connection. So can I use my MacBook Pro to copy any updates from Apple and any other downloads that I want to put on my iMac and then take them back to the iMac and run them on that program? I'm thinking of using ChronoSync for basically syncing my files between the two items, and SuperSync to keep my iTunes music between the two MacBook and the iMac together. Any help that you can give me with this would be very much appreciated. So basically the iMac has no internet connection and the MacBook Pro has internet connection, and I want to keep my iMac up to date via the MacBook Pro. This is where you can cut me off.
Awesome. All right. So I think that, John, the short answer on this is yes, you can certainly do this, right?
Yes. And here's where you go, Dave.
Okay.
And we can toss this around a bit. But the place that you want to go, so of course there's two ways to update your software on the Mac and make sure it's up to date. One, of course, is software update, but in this case, because it's not connected, that's not going to work. The other thing you can do, or at least in this case, I would not use that mechanism because that's not portable. I mean, if he updates his MacBook Pro, he's not going to get something that he can bring over to the iMac, at least not easily, and I wouldn't even suggest trying to take that route.
Agreed.
You may be able to dig into the rear seats, or even the net. We're not even going to talk about it because it's a terrible idea. Here's the other thing you do. You go to support.apple.com/downloads. And guess what? That's where all the stuff. Now, sometimes, you know, I've seen a little tension between things showing up there versus when they show up in software updates. Sometimes I've seen them show up. I think usually they show up in software update first, but they will eventually show up in support.apple.com/downloads.
Right.
So the only caution, though I don't think it's a big deal, is that there may be updates that are specific to the iMac that will not work on the MacBook Pro and the other way around. But I think for the most part, if you try to download an update that doesn't apply to a certain machine, Apple's pretty good about doing a check and saying, what are you doing? So, you know, if you try to apply a firmware update or a hardware update to a machine that can't accept it, it's going to say, no way, man.
Right.
So in short, I think that's the answer is absolutely you can do this. The only thing is, I don't know, I was just scratching my head over this, Dave. How would you even know, other than going to a, you know, cool site like MacObserver.com, how would you know that a new update is coming out? And I wonder if you can monitor. How would you? We didn't script this. I'm just wondering, could you monitor support.apple.com/downloads and see if anything new shows up?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because that would be my only concern here, is that you are having to download and pick which updates you're going to get without having that computer. One of the best parts about software update from my standpoint is not that it takes care of updating my software, but that it tells me what updates I need, right? So like you said, if there's an update for the Mac Pro that comes out, well, that doesn't show up on my computer, nor would I want it to. You know, I don't need it. I think if you go to support.apple.com/downloads, you can drill down by product. You can go to desktops and then iMac, and you can start to see recent, and you can sort it alphabetically or in date order. And you can start to see now, you know, there's firmware updates, but it's, you know, it doesn't, you can't get any more detailed than that. You can't say, I want to find the updates for my, at least I don't think, please, if you know, tell us so that we can pass this along to Philip and the rest of the listeners. But I don't think you can tell it, you know, I have early 2010 iMac with a, you know, 2.8 gigahertz processor, and find me all my updates. I don't think there's a way to do that. I certainly can't seem to find a way, but that's software update was. And it's too bad that you can't do that, because could you? You know, there is, you could get geeky on this. There is the file. The software update goes and grabs a file and compares not only what it has already downloaded, but also the ID of your machine to everything in that file. And so it would be possible, but convoluted, to go and say, okay, these are the updates I need for my machine. But I don't think there's another way to do that.
Yeah, you know, I was looking and I don't see, but I was thinking maybe there's an RSS feed, but I don't see RSS show up when I look at this particular web page. And it's funny, this is actually very timely, Dave. I'm looking right now and I saw just today, is today the 12th? I think it is. Yes.
Yeah.
There just happened to be, I'm looking on the list here, iMac mid 2010 display brightness update. So an update just came out today for the iMac.
Right. Now here's what you could do. Well, you know, I just searched for iMac mid 2010 in Apple's downloads, and it certainly found a lot of them, but it also found an update for the 13-inch MacBook Pro mid 2010. So, you know, you'd have to get kind of funny with searching. Yeah, I don't know that there's a magic answer here.
I think the best you can do is check this page every, again, either just, you know, hook into the cool Mac sites or both. Maybe check this page every week or however often you'd like to check it and see if anything shows up. Because, a lot of these are not, you know, entirely... some are critical. I mean, you know, especially the security ones are critical. You know, something like this here, display brightness update, unless you're having a problem,
right,
is probably not a
well, you know, security updates are not critical for Philip. Not even close. That computer's not connected to the internet. I wouldn't, you know.
You actually brought up an excellent point, Dave. Well, I've seen this in the past. People have said that the most secure computer is one that's not hooked to a network.
Yeah.
Because short of physical access where somebody can steal your data,
right.
you really don't have too much to worry about.
No. So, so for him, you know, his priority with updates might be a whole lot different from the rest of us or even himself on his other computer that's always connected. So,
okay.
All right. We have an interesting story from Honor that we wanted to share with regards to permissions. Honor says, I just fixed my broken Mac Mini with Snow Leopard server installed on it. When I rebooted the Mini, ouch, gray screen, Apple logo, spinning indicator. No good. I booted in verbose mode and saw something like MDNS responder, no such file directory for /usr/sbin/launchd. So I looked in this list system library launch daemons com.apple.msd DNS responder plist file, and you get good geek points for that, Honor. All the defined paths seem to be in order. When I invoked usr/sbin/mdnsresponder-launchd in single user mode, no problem, just fine. So I searched on our friendly, not evilish, search engine and found a forum topic that over at Mac Rumors that basically boiled it down to incorrect permissions on slash, which is the root. It should have been 775, but was 770. I have no idea what changed the permissions, but I changed them back and it worked fine. After the whole thing, I also ran Applejack in auto mode. So great. I'm glad you were using that, Honor. Yeah. So 770 means that the world can read the world can read and write. Groups can read and write, but the root user can do nothing.
Well, no,
isn't
I think
right?
it's the other way
like,
around.
I'm going the other way around, right?
Right. I believe it's owner.
I went backwards. You're right.
So to map it up, it's here, but that's okay. So when you see permissions, it's laid out in bits. So
right.
There are three bits, and it could be 0 through 4, 5, 6, 7. Could be the value for each, but yes. So anyways, yeah, because I put this in my notes today because I get confused sometimes too. So it's owner, group, and others, or everyone.
Right.
So in this case, everyone was set to 0, which basically means, well, it depends on, you know, who wants to access it, but anything being set to 0, I think, is potentially a disaster, as we saw.
Right. Yep. So other was set to 0, which meant it could do nothing. But in single user mode, when you were booted in as the root user and permissions, you know, sort of get ignored, it didn't matter. So that's very interesting. Have no idea how it got changed that way, but it's always nice to be reminded that a simple permissions repair can solve even what may seem to be the worst problem. And, you know, I have not done a permissions repair on my MacBook Pro. I can't imagine that would solve it, especially since booting from other drives does not solve this problem. But you know, it never hurts. Next. Are we ready, John?
What's next?
Greg?
Greg?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So Greg writes, do you know what show it was where you talked about sending from Gmail in the Mail app? Meaning the Verizon outgoing SMTP port is blocked when on certain networks. So I want to use my Verizon account, but I want to send via Gmail's outgoing server, but still make it appear to be coming from my Verizon address so that when people reply, it goes back to that email address. If I send using my Verizon account but configure it to use Gmail outgoing, it appears to my recipients that the message came from my Gmail account. How do I change it, and what show was that? I believe it was recent in show 264, but...
Well, the quick answer is no. Let's move on.
What?
No, I'm just kidding. Come on, we got to get moving here. No, we got a lot of stuff here that I want to get to, Dave. But anyways, no, you actually, and you had actually taught me about this in the past here, and I'll let you go on. Sorry,
okay.
Sorry for being silly, but
no.
There is a way to do this, and I think it's actually a security mechanism that Gmail institutes that I think is a good thing.
I agree. Gmail, because they offer free accounts and are essentially world sendable by anyone, they have to make sure that when you send an email via their servers, that you are sending it from an address that Gmail knows you control. Okay. Because otherwise you could, you know, just get a Gmail account, send out a bunch of spam. It gets closed down. No problem. You move on to the next one. No big deal. There's no repercussions. There's no way for anyone to find you. So what they've done is, by default, if you send mail through Gmail, regardless of what you tell your mail client. Now, I'm not talking about Gmail in the web interface. What I'm talking about is what Greg means, where you set up Gmail as your outbound SMTP server in Mail app on your Mac. And the reason for doing this is exactly what Greg describes. You want to be able to send mail no matter where you are. And as I said, Gmail lets you do that. But it no matter what you set in your mail app. So if I have, you know, my dave@gmail.com account, but I send, and that's not my Gmail account, but of course, davehamilton@gmail.com is my account. But some other guy out there thinks it's his, and he recently signed up for not only job postings to be emailed to him, but also he signed up for a dating service. So that's
good. Dave, I get the same thing. I have gotten, I can't believe it. I have gotten class assignments because apparently there's instructor named John Braun out there.
Yep.
I've gotten wills. I've gotten real estate documents.
Nice.
Oh, yeah. Religious news. It's amazing that well, again, I've even gotten emails saying, dude, are you using your Gmail? Right. You know, and I'm going to say it's johnbraun@gmail.com. Not right. A big surprise.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, so I was the first, as you were, Dave, I'm sure.
Yeah.
We're one of the first people to get on the Gmail bandwagon. And yeah, I mean, some of the stuff that I get in addition to, and I've looked at this and then we'll move on. I've looked at my spam folder, Dave. I let it roll because I think Gmail, as you told me, I shouldn't really touch the spam. But I let it roll to the 30-day expiration. I get about 4,000 spams in my spam folder.
It's nothing.
Okay. All right. You're a lot more popular than I am. But I look, and as some of you may know, or if you don't, they will expire spam that they put in the spam folder that's older than 30 days.
Right.
So I thought 4,000 or 5,000 was huge. So what do you get? What, 10, 20?
Orders of magnitude larger in a 30-day period.
And it's just insane because, again, it's... And I got to say, I'm amazed when stuff gets through.
Right.
And it does, very reliably. I look through spam.
I'm going to grab the reins here and get back to Greg's question. Because there's actually another discussion to have about the spam thing again. But anyway, so... Greg, if I send an email from my mail client and I tell mail, send it from and appear to be from dave@macobserver.com and I send it through Gmail, if I haven't changed anything else on Gmail and I send it through my davehamilton@gmail.com account, it will appear to whomever I send it that it came from davehamilton@gmail.com. And this is because Gmail needs to make sure the people that get your email know it was you. Understood. So how do you change this? Well, you go into Gmail. Now you're on the web. You go into Gmail, click on settings, click on accounts. And then there's a little link that says add another email address you own. You put in the email address and click verify. What happens is Gmail sends you an email to that address. So in my case, it would send to my dave@macobserver.com account and it would have two pieces of information in it. One is a link. And the other is a series of random digits. You can confirm it one way or another. You either click the link or you take the digits and, you know, copy and paste them into your Gmail account. Once you've confirmed that you've gotten this email and you have access to that email account, well, at that point, you now have a second email in your accounts list in Gmail. And you can add tons of these. You can pick which one you want to be default, and that changes it in the web interface. But once you have something listed here, then you click on there's an option right below that that says when receiving a message, change it to reply from the same address the message was sent to. This kind of opens the floodgates to allow you to send from any of the addresses that you have verified and confirmed in the Gmail interface. Then I could go back to my mail client and do the same thing I did before. Send a message from dave@macobserver.com through my Gmail account. And when the person on the other end gets it, it comes from dave@macobserver.com, which is exactly what I would have wanted. So that's how you do it. It was a kind of a winding yet hopefully informative discussion. But that's the magic answer there, Greg. and anyone else that's doing it. So, All right. Another Greg wrote in, John, in response to your cool stuff found on the last show, you mentioned HDR photographs and you can use HD artist. And Pilot Pete told me, John, Pilot Pete will be here Monday, by the way. But Pilot Pete told me that he was the one that told you about HD artist and that that you neglected to give him credit. So I'm supposed to give you guff about that. So consider yourself guffed.
Well, no, he didn't. No, with someone else on another pod. But anyways, no, it's traveled in the, he may have been. But anyways, HDR, high dynamic range.
Yep.
Just to remind folks, it is a way to get, it makes your photos sometimes look a lot better. But anyways, Greg clues us in on something that,
It's called HDR, HDR or Pro HDR. And it's an app for the iPhone that lets you do the same thing with either the iPhone 4 or the iPhone 3GS, full res pictures, and it'll take three different versions and mash them together. And apparently you can do some tweaks in it. I haven't tested it out. I just found out about it earlier today, but I did want to share that
You got it because, your wife there has the big boy or big girl cameras, yeah, Dave. I mean, right. I'm convinced, I have like a pro, not even prosumer, but you have an awesome camera at your disposal. You got to try this stuff.
I will.
I think you get some great results. Anyways.
I promise I will.
Splendid.
How are we doing on time here?
51 minutes.
All right. Well, let's answer, pick a question. It doesn't matter which one it is. I'm happy to do the one that's
in
order, or we can pick one from the extras and let's do that. So it's up to you, Mr. Braun.
Extras, I'm going to go for, I like Vito, but I'm going to go for Kevin because I think people will like the answer.
Okay. Kevin writes, let me make sure I have the right one from Kevin. I do. A recent question was posted to our Double Click Mug discussion group. Someone wrote, I have a higher need for security since I have been processing credit cards on my computer and would like to know if there was any software out there that gives me anonymity. I gave the group feedback on general security measures, i.e. physical security, good passwords, ways to tighten up the OS and Safari browser, but did not answer his question. His response further clarified his concern. He says, now about my original question, I've been told that my IP address is easy to get, and once it is obtained, all of my internet visits can be tracked. I don't like that, and that's the next problem I want to solve. He's firewalled from his ISP through an Apple Airport Extreme router, but he wants more anonymity than that can provide. By the way, his bank security firm gave him a passing grade on his router for being PCI, payment card industry compliant. Okay. I'll start with this, John, and then pass it to you.
Okay.
All right. He's right. His internet visits can be tracked by the people he's visiting. Right. But any one of them can't see everywhere he's been. For example, if this user comes, any user comes and visits MacObserver.com, we get their IP address. And we know that someone from that IP address came to the site. And perhaps we also could know that that same person, by tracking the IP address, came back later. But we don't necessarily know who that is. We can just identify it by IP. We could also drop a cookie, and we do for some of our internal tracking, but it's all sort of aggregated. So we don't know that, who it is. But I certainly, from a Mac Observer standpoint, don't know any other sites they visit. So if he goes and visits, Apple.com, well, we don't have that information. We Apple doesn't send us their logs, and I wouldn't even care to see them, right? It's sort of irrelevant. But, let's take it one step up. We also have Backbeat Media here, which is an advertising group that manages the ads for a lot of different Mac sites. So we can know if you visit Mac Observer and then you also visit, say, Mac Forums, and then Low End Mac and then Mac Surfer, we could know that the same IP address visited. And in some ways we want to know, because we don't want to have to show, we don't want to show you the same ad on every site unless the advertiser wants that. So we can do some controls like that. But again, we don't necessarily know who you are, and we also can't track you on other sites. But taking it a step larger, something like DoubleClick, which is the ad network that Google now owns, they're on a lot of different sites, you know, thousands and thousands of sites, so they can start to track you around the web. But here's the thing. Your credit card company, the site that you go to process these credit cards, doesn't have tracking cookies or tracking bugs from, certainly not from us, nor from DoubleClick, nor anything else, because DoubleClick doesn't need to know that you were at this site that just processes credit cards. And we do the same thing here. We use a service called AuthorizeNet, which lets us process credit cards on the web. And in fact, you've all used it because via FoxyCart, that's how you're getting your that's how you're paying for MacGeek Cab Premium. So I don't get the concern. I'm not sure I understand the concern, but specifically with the question, I don't know of any way of hiding your IP address from sites, but I think, John, you do.
Absolutely. Now, there is a system. So, you know, at first I looked at this and I'm like, well, no, how do we hide this? But I actually use this. I'm going to give you an example of when I use this.
Okay.
There is a system called Tor. What is Tor, you may ask?
What is Tor?
And when I read it here, well, actually, and there's a package that encapsulates Tor called Vidalia. Vidalia, is that right? But Vidalia? It's a type of onion.
Like an onion?
Exactly. And that's the whole thing around Tor, is that it's like an onion and that you have to go through multiple layers to figure out what the heck is going on. So the thing is, I use this system. So they offer, and we're going to link to it, of course. They do have a runtime. Now, the most convenient implementation of this that I've seen is through Firefox. And they actually have a plugin. Now, I remember when I got really, really... So what does Tor do? What Tor does is it is a network of people that offer servers that will basically anonymize your IP address. So if you have this plugin and you're tied into the Tor network and you get into the Tor network, the IP that is presented to the site you're going to is not your IP. It's the IP of whoever is offering the Tor server. So in the past, and actually I think this is very clever. Now, you know, some people may ask, why would you need this? Well,
yeah, I can imagine.
I can imagine all sorts of things. Say you're a whistleblower, say you're undercover. I mean, technology is neither good nor evil.
Right.
So there are reasons where you may not want. Now, one, you could say, well, gee, I don't want an advertising network to know where I'm coming from to target ads to me. And, you know, that's kind of silly, I think. But if you're, doing, you know, heavy duty, spy stuff and you don't want the enemy, whoever they may be, to know where you are, because, you know, an IP, for the most part, can fairly accurately, you know, as you said, Dave, you can target ads, which I think personally, I think is a good thing.
You can target ads. Code. Yeah.
Right, and I've seen that, and we won't go into detail about that.
That's right.
But anyways, so what happens is, and actually, so the example I'll give is that there was, when the iPad was coming out, the BBC had some news reports about the iPad, and I was like, oh, well, that's really cool, man, I went and checked out. So I went on Safari, went to YouTube, looked up the video that someone had given me a link to, and the thing came up and said, sorry, dude, you're in the U.S. We're the BBC. We're dissing you. We're not going to show you the video. I'm like, oh, no, you don't. So basically,
did you wag your finger and kind of move your head from side to side when you said that?
No, I just fired up Firefox with the Tor plugin. Now, the thing is, as far as I know, Tor does not let you control where you're coming, where you appear to be coming from.
Sure.
But when I started up Tor through Firefox, it made it appear the first time I ran it that I was coming from Germany. Now, of course, Germany is in Europe, and apparently the licensing or whatever agreement the BBC has said, oh, hi, John, you're coming from Germany? Great, we're going to show you this iPad video that's on the BBC because we know you're in Europe and not in the United States.
Interesting.
So,
cool.
So the thing is, Tor, now I don't think it works for everything. Well, it's a plugin for Firefox, and they also have a standalone program, as I mentioned, called Vidalia. I don't know the gory details, but I do know that it is available for Windows, Mac OS X. You can get the source code, and of course we'll link to it, but it's called Tor. it tours the network. Vidalia is an implementation of it that works on a lot of systems. But to your point, Dave, I mean,
I'm gonna throw two things out there. Actually, number one
go.
Is
tinfoil hat.
Yeah, a little bit, but not so much. Actually, I'll be relatively sane with this stuff. First of all, your IP address is anonymized except to the person or persons running this Tor server that you happen to connect to. So, you know, be aware that you're anonymizing by the good graces of others, and they could track you if they wanted to.
And I have heard of, and actually you bring up a great point, I've heard of cases where, yes, you could certainly get somebody setting up a Tor server that is evil.
Yeah.
In which case,
that's the traffic you want to sniff. It's like, hey, why do people want to hide themselves? Who are these people? Let me look. That right.
Because that's the same argument that some people use to say, well, why do you want to use PGP or why do you want to use encryption in general?
Right.
If you're using that, you have something to hide. So we're going to watch you closely. That's an excellent point. Thank you.
Number two is I know my bank, if they start seeing credit card requests that are supposed to be from my one computer coming from various different IPs all over the place, that may raise a red flag on their end. So yes. By using one of these anonymizers, you may actually cause yourself not a security problem, but you know, they may lock your account until they can get in touch with you and find out, hey, what's going on here? Why, you know, why are suddenly people all over the world, you know, if your behavior changes, which is from their standpoint, it would, that may be enough to put a red flag in place. So yeah, I don't, you know, I'm not sure the magic answer here because I don't know this person in the specific situation, but I don't quite get why you'd want to anonymize in this situation. It may simply be that a lack of understanding of you know, he clearly was told people can get my address and perhaps it wasn't explained in enough detail to give him the information to make his decision. So hopefully we've helped with that. Right. And
I'm with you. You have to weigh when you want privacy, you have to weigh, you know, is somebody going to notice that? No, as you said, Dave, I mean, sometimes I'll get a call every now and then, though I have a little dispute with Discover right now, but I'll get a call every now and then from my credit card company saying, oh, we noticed something that looks kind of weird.
Right.
Did you buy this here and this here and this here? And I'm like, yes, I did. They're like, okay, thank you very much.
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
Well,
right.
Well, no, I'm going to shake my fist right now. I'm having a problem with Discover because they're being quite lax in a recent fraud event I had.
That's not good. Not good.
No, somebody charged $5,000 to my card, and they're in a totally different part of the country, and I had to call them to find out why my account got deactivated.
Oh, nice.
So I'm sorry, Discover, I'm shaking my fist, and the thing is I haven't yet got a replacement card. They seem to be really...
That's frustrating. You should do it overnight.
Yeah, well, when I called on Monday, they promised that. Now, I don't know if they think I'm the evil guy trying to because basically somebody
that you are.
Yeah, well, in some context, basically, I don't know if their security people think I'm the evil guy trying to impersonate myself.
Right.
Or what? Because I got to say, the job of those people is incredibly difficult.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's customer service at the same time as limiting people's access to the customer.
Well, you and I talked about this.
Yeah.
Customer service is meant to give you a pleasant experience.
Correct.
Security is meant to prevent customer service from being
right.
Well, the problem is, which group do you go to?
That's right.
So anyways, you know what? I've been seeing more and more tweets from a lot of our Mac colleagues with weird credit card things. And yeah, it just makes me nervous.
You can email us. I know you all know this because you're here as premium subscribers. And actually, I'd like to thank you, John, and I very much appreciate you supporting what we do here. You can email us to premium@macgeekgab.com, or you can call us.
Dave, I want to ask you, did you say premium?
You know, I said premium@macgeekgab.com.
I just want to make sure.
I meant it. 206-666-GEEK is the number to call, and that is
4-3-3-3. 5.
That's right. You can Skype us to Mac right. Geek Gab, and of course you can post iTunes comments and all of that good stuff. John and I will, assuming we can get flights that actually work, John and I will be at Blog World Expo. Ooh. And I believe I'm going to be speaking there, but it hasn't been entirely confirmed, but I'm pretty sure I am.
Really?
And that's October 15th through 14th through 16th. Is and out in Las Vegas. And you can sign up anytime before September 15th, and you can get 20% off by using our special code OBSERVERVIP, OBSERVERVIP, because you are VIPs. Michael Johnston from the We Have Communicators podcast converts this to AAC, and CashFly provides all the bandwidth. I think that's it, John. We're out of here, right? We'll see you Monday for, and Pete will be here.
Sweet. So, Dave, you're on the train.
For a really long time.
Oh, that's too bad, but...
It was 45 minutes delayed leaving the station, and then we lost another hour and a half in the process because some power outage happened early yesterday morning.
So that means...
I got caught.